This is an iHeart podcast.
Do you want to have the most uncomfortable conversation in the world? We're about to do that tonight. We have Adam Coleman here, Aaron McIntyre here. This show is so packed. I don't know how we're going to get to it all on I'm Right. The president's a pedophile. Stop. Just hang with me for a moment. We'll get to the latest news that came out of the DOJ. I'll explain myself in a moment, but just process that while I talk here, while you listen to me talk here. The president of the United States of America very likely is a pedophile. Now, let's pause on that. Set that little tidbit aside for a moment. Let's talk about you. I want you to picture this. Somebody you hate. Someone who hates you, more specifically. They hate you. They're getting ready to take out an article in the newspaper, the local newspaper in your town, and they're going to print some pretty nasty stuff. And what they're going to print in the newspaper is that you deal black tar heroin. You're a black tar heroin dealer. And in your spare time, you like to walk around town and kick puppies. Right? And you don't wash your hands after you use the bathroom. Now, you probably rolling your eyes, maybe even smirking right now. Why? Well, you wouldn't even really care that much because none of that stuff is true. That's why. Look, if somebody took out an article about me in the local newspaper and said I was black tar heroin puppy kicking Jesse, I would laugh. I'd probably come on here. We'd probably publicize it here on the show. Hey, look what some idiot said. Bunch of lies about me. What's the big deal? You wouldn't care, right? But if somebody who hates you knew your darkest secrets, and we all have them. We all have things we don't love to broadcast about ourselves, things we're ashamed of. If they knew your darkest secrets and you found out they planned on printing those in the local newspaper, well, I don't know what steps you would take from there, but you would care, wouldn't you? Now, let's talk about the president of the United States of America, his daughter, his public conduct. Joe Biden has a daughter. Her name is Ashley. The DOJ of the United States of America, they're currently seeking prison time for a woman. This is the DOJ seeking prison time. Now, what did this woman do? What did this woman do that would merit that kind of gaze from the DOJ? Do you have any idea how many cases cross the DOJ's desk? How many they just dismiss? They don't even have time to get to everything. Hey, we got to focus on the drug lords and stuff. Yet, they want to send this woman to prison. So what did she do? Well, back in 2021, James O'Keefe, then with Project Veritas, came across the diary. He was offered a diary. Okay, who did the offering? Ashley Biden, Joe Biden's daughter, had been renting a house, renting a property, left a bunch of her things behind. Believe it or not, you ever talk to a renter, maybe you are a renter, this is a common thing. People will just leave their crap behind. And after a while, it's always written in the paperwork, after a while, those things you left behind stop being your things and they go to whoever owns the home. Hey, you left it here, it's ours now. Either way, we don't have to get into the legality or morality of that. One of the things she left behind was a diary. And in this diary, there were some, I'm not even sure exactly how to approach this on a family show, so I'm going to be very, very delicate here. There were things that were disgusting. The kind of things you read and you kind of recoil in horror. She talks about how she was hypersexualized at a young age. That's a direct quote, hypersexualized. On to claims about Joe Biden entering the shower with her. And from reading the diary, look, you can read it yourself. I'm not going to go into all the details of it. This wasn't some kind of a one-off thing. This is apparently something she feared a lot as a child. Okay, so already this is bad. This is really, really bad. Now, all this stuff was alleged. We knew there was a diary and we knew this stuff was in it, but we didn't know the authenticity of it. Was it even Ashley Biden's diary? We don't know. But then We got actually two different kinds of confirmation that it was Ashley Biden's diary. The first being Ashley Biden is actually on camera now. We have video evidence. So if your liberal Aunt Peggy tries to deny anything I'm trying to say here, you can just go look at the video. There's video evidence now, courtesy of Project Veritas, of Ashley Biden confirming that the diary was in fact hers. So, okay, we know the diary's hers. But that wasn't the confirmation we actually needed. The real confirmation we needed is when the FBI kicked in James O'Keefe's door, when they had him half naked, handcuffed in the hallway of his home. What crime? Was it that black tar heroin? No, it was the crime of threatening to publicize this diary. Now, what in the world would concern Joe Biden to such a degree that he would have one of his people make a phone call to the DOJ and say, hey, guys, there's this diary out there. James O'Keefe has it. We can't have that diary coming out. How afraid of the things in that diary must Joe Biden be? And let's circle back to the things that are in that diary that are really bad. And look, you can play it again, Mr. Producer, when you combine that with the video and picture evidence we have of how Joe Biden conducts himself around children, not just his own. Look, it's treated oftentimes, and I'm probably guilty of this myself, as some kind of a snickering one-off joke on the right. The sniffing president, what's it gonna nuzzle her? Like we make jokes about it. And again, I'm not acting like I'm not guilty of that. But have you ever spoken to anyone in law enforcement, anyone in child advocacy, anyone who deals with child predators? You ever spoken to them, spent any time with them, talked to them about what they do? Ask them what they think about that kind of conduct, that kind of weirdly way too affectionate conduct with children and the types of people who conduct themselves with children that way. Look, I know this is an uncomfortable conversation. He's the president of the United States of America. I'm uncomfortable too. All this is uncomfortable. But we have to have this discussion. That's how child predators act around children. Even old people who love kids, you know, they try to use that excuse before. I've been around old people my entire life. In fact, I purposely spend as much time around them as possible. I enjoy soaking up the wisdom and the time with them. I've been around old people who love children. I've never once been around an old person who had to grab and snuggle and sniff and hug. That's not how nice old people act. That's how child predators act. Do you know anyone in your life, maybe you yourself, God forbid, have gone through things like this with adults? A parent, a relative, a little league coach, whatever it may be. You know exactly what I'm saying is true. How Joe Biden acts publicly around children is the ultimate red flag. President of the United States of America very likely is a pedophile. Not trying to do radical over-the-top TV. I know everyone's going to yell and scream about this. Look at the videos. Look at the picture. Look at the diary. We now know it's true. He's so worried about this information coming out, as any politician would be. He sent the FBI after the guy who allegedly had his daughter's diary. Innocent people don't do that. And if the diary was full of lies, you wouldn't do that. You do that when you're a very evil, very corrupt man and the diary is full of truth. You know what I'm saying is true. And look, not that it matters. He's in such poor health at this point in time. I don't know how long he's even going to be able to speak. You see the latest and greatest. Nothing on Joe Biden's public schedule today. That's absurd for a president. Although it happens all the time with him. Well, no, I'm sorry. I don't have anything on the schedule. It looks like I'm all booked up. Yesterday, though, he had something. He showed up an hour late to it. And keep in mind, this something was at noon. And he showed up an hour late to it. And people couldn't help but notice after he showed up an hour late to it that he had these lines on his face. What kind of lines are those? Well, maybe you recognize those lines. Maybe you wear one of these yourself. Maybe you know someone who does. Those are CPAP machine lines. Folks who struggle with snoring, sleep apnea, this gets to be a bigger and bigger problem as you get older. It's an oxygen machine, essentially, that you attach to your face as you sleep. You don't walk around wearing one of these while you're awake. You attach one of these to your face when you're asleep. So let me circle back to something I was just saying a second ago. This event was at noon. He showed up an hour late. It took them an extra hour to get President Bad Touch out of bed, get his CPAP machine off his face, and get him dressed so he could show up at a speech. And at that speech, he showed up and he talked like this.
But the Republicans were able to cut back on the fact that the only thing they couldn't defeat was the seniors. Now, this spring is here. The seasons and allergies are upon us. We're on the rise even more. And the mechanism and the mechanisms attached to the inhaler.
Yeah. Look, it's really bad. This video is making the rounds. Sage Steele, she's a great person, used to be with ESPN. She's going out there and she's saying this publicly, but before I go to Sage Steele, I want to remind you that this interview Sage Steele was referencing that she did with Joe Biden, she did this while she was at ESPN as a sports reporter. Joe Biden wasn't walking into some interview with me where he could expect some seriously hostile, nasty questions. He's sitting down with ESPN for the ultimate softball interview because ESPN's a dirty commie company. So he's basically going, hey, Joe, what's your favorite team? It's going to be a lot of that. And even then, they had to script every single word just so he could get by.
That was an interesting experience in its own right because it was so structured and I was told, you will say every word that we write out, you will not deviate from the script and go to the word. Like every single question was scripted, gone over dozens of times by many executives, editors and executives. Absolutely. I was on script and was told not to deviate.
I know a lot of this stuff has become baked in the cake for us because we're used to having this president by now, but you do understand that the president should be sharper than you, right? Sharper than me. He has the most important job in the world. If you were to sit down with the American president, ideally, no matter what he was, Republican or Democrat, mentally, he should be able to run circles around you, around me. Oh my gosh, I can't even keep up with this guy. He's so full of knowledge. He's so quick on his feet. Our president can't sit down with ESPN and talk about baseball and basketball without having a speech written for him and the questions beforehand. We are in some trouble, are we not? All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I am right. We're going to talk about the border and other things with Adam B. Coleman next. Before we get to Adam, we're going to talk about Lone Star Transfer and the timeshare you think you're stuck in. You're not. You can get out of your timeshare. But you can't get out of your timeshare by calling the timeshare company or by emailing the timeshare company. I know you've already tried that. And I know what they've said back to you. You know, you signed the contract. You're calling the wrong people. Call the ones who will set you free. Lone Star Transfer has helped over 20,000 timeshare owners legally and permanently get out. Stop paying the freaking annual fees, the special assessments. Stop being told, sorry, we're all booked up this year, and just be free of it. This is a family business. They're wonderful people. They're successful 99% of the time. It's not like you're rolling the dice here. They put it in writing. Call them. 844-310-2646. We'll be back.
Hey there, I'm Mary Catherine Hamm.
And I'm Carol Markowitz. We've been in political media for a long time.
Long enough to know that it's gotten, well, a little insane.
That's why we started Normally, a podcast for people who are over the hysteria and just want clarity.
We talk about the issues that actually matter to the country without panic, without yelling, and with a healthy dose of humor.
We don't take ourselves too seriously, but we do take the truth seriously.
So if you're into common sense, sanity, and some occasional sass,
you're our kind of people.
Catch new episodes of Normally every Tuesday and Thursday
on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen.
And why isn't federal immigration law tougher on border crossers who come here and are accused of serious crimes?
So, are you speaking of a specific case?
There's this story in New York, an 8-person crew of border crossers found with drugs and guns. 6 of them now are out on bail. Does President Biden think policies like that are making the country safer?
So I want to be really careful. That's an active case, so don't want to comment on an active case. But anyone found guilty, and we've been very clear about that, anyone found guilty of a crime should be held accountable. We have been very, very clear about that.
Whenever they say they've been very clear, that's a good sign they're lying and haven't been clear about anything. Joining me now, Adam B. Coleman, author of the book Black Victim to Black Victor. Adam, they've been very clear. They've been very clear that they want the border open. What seems to confuse so many people on the right is why. Why do these people want the country flooded with illegals?
I think... That's even a question I sometimes have a hard trouble answering, because sometimes I think it's malicious and sometimes I think it's just incompetence. And I often think the type of issues that we see coming from, especially Democrat leaders these days, is incompetence more so than malevolence. From the incompetence standpoint and just playing partisan politics, when Joe Biden got into office, he basically just wanted to do anything that was the opposite of what Trump did. So if Trump was strong on the border, he wanted to be weak on the border. And any type of action that Biden did that was objectively wrong and wasn't working, they defended it just like any other politician would. So I think part of that is incompetence. Now, I do think that there is an effort to kind of keep it going by some of them as to why money. I think there are a lot of lobbying interests, maybe not necessarily on the national level, but on the local level. I'm near New York City, and the hotel lobby loves this. They lost a ton of money during COVID because of lack of tourism, and all of a sudden they got guaranteed money, inflated prices that they wouldn't have never made, 100% occupancy rates for some of their hotels. I mean, money is definitely a huge factor, and they're one of the strongest lobbies within the city and within the state, I should say. So, I mean, money is definitely a big part of it. There are lots of people who are making money off of this situation.
Adam, you have a great piece up in the Telegraph talking about something I've been concerned about for quite some time. Our enemies exploiting the fact we have an open border. It's not just that we have an open border, it's that everybody knows it. So any Tom, Dick, and Harry coming from anywhere can come pouring across that border. We got Chinese men pouring across the border. Who knows what they're doing here? It's a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to me, it's the most obvious reason why you'd want to have a secure border. It's quite literally, as a child who watched, our Twin Towers go down, because of terrorists coming into our country, and we're supposed to learn this hard lesson about security, right? Well, here we are saying that the border is just this invisible line, and what does that even mean anymore? We have to become the safety net for the entire world and take our eye off the ball when it comes to security. But security is a really, really big issue. There are a lot of people who do not like us. As Mitch, is there a lot of countries that do like us and like working with us? There are a lot of countries that don't like us. And there are a lot of, organizations, small terrorist organizations that do not like us. So, in that piece, I'm highlighting how there's an ISIS component when it came to the attacks in Russia. And what's there to stop them from coming after us? We are incredibly vulnerable. And in the piece, I highlight how the FBI has talked about this. They've caught people who are on the terrorist watch list. Like, we know that there's attempts to have these types of people come in. There is a human trafficker with ISIS links that was helping to bring Uzbek migrants into our country. They know about this, right? So the intelligence agencies know that we're incredibly vulnerable. There have been attempts from people who are malicious who have entered our country. Whether they have a plan or don't have a plan, I don't know. But this is a real concern.
Adam, I have a theory on something the Democrats are doing with illegal immigration, because I couldn't figure something out. They brought in all these illegals. And then when they get shuttled to these Democrat-run cities, where are they putting them? They're putting them in the black neighborhoods. Doing it in Chicago, doing it in New York City. Black people in these neighborhoods are upset, obviously. Now, all of a sudden, you know, the class sizes are huge. The rec centers are gone. They're voicing their displeasure loudly. Yet these dirty commies haven't backed off at all. They're still just shoving them in there. I believe Democrats are moving on to a different voting bloc. I think they see, at least slowly, their guaranteed black vote going away. Obviously, that's going to be slow. But I think they're simply not worried about it. They're just finding replacements. Am I wrong?
Not necessarily. Here's a couple things to think about. We'll use Chicago and New York as an example. Mayor Adams does not like this. Mayor Adams was fighting Joe Biden's administration, even went to D.C. and said, you need to stop and do something about this, or you need to pay for this, right? And D.C. is not giving him much of anything. So Mayor Adams, in my opinion, he's not the commie type. Even in Chicago, they went to D.C. as well. Even though Brandon Johnson is more of the progressive slash commie type, in my opinion, he didn't necessarily like this either. And so I think whenever you get crap, you put it in the poor neighborhood. I think that's just what ends up happening. And within these cities, the poor neighborhoods are black, Hispanic, ethnic neighborhoods. And so that's just where people are going. So they filled up the hotels, they fill up the parks. And of course, I mean, they're not going to put it in the wealthy neighborhoods first, right? I mean, if it comes down to that, that's the last option we'd ever want to do, right? Because those people go out and vote. Those people, you know, help to support our campaigns. They complain the loudest, right? I mean, when they complain, it matters more than when poor people complain. But I think that's more so what's happening. It's a reaction to when you're getting an influx of people, because managing people is the hardest thing you could possibly do. What are you going to do? Well, you put them in the poor areas first, because the poor people complain no matter what. And if nothing changes, nothing changes for them. But this is the reality. So I don't know. I don't know if it's necessarily exactly what you're saying. I think it's just more so of a reaction.
Yeah, they shipped him into Martha's Vineyard. They had him out of there in 48 hours. Exactly. Those liberal white women were crying on the way out the door. Adam, exactly. Thank you, brother. All right. Christianity. Government's declared war on it. You can't see it. You're blind. We're going to talk to Aron McIntyre about that next. Before we talk to Aron about that, let's talk about what we can do. Okay. Here's what we very clearly can't do. We can't get these people to stop spending and printing money. It doesn't matter how loud you scream or I scream, Republican, Democrat, they don't care. They're getting ready to meet again in about 5 minutes and just more gobs of money to Ukraine. Just whatever, everybody, just money for everybody. So you know what's going to happen with the dollar. You're not an idiot. You understand. So all we can do is prepare. Prepare for a future where the dollar isn't worth even what it's worth today. And I know that's bad. We have to prepare for a future where things get really rocky. You prepare the same way nation states are currently preparing, the same way finance giants are currently preparing. You know what they're doing? They're buying gold. They're buying silver. They're snatching up gobs of gold and silver. Let Oxford Gold Group do that for you. No, you're not going to be able to buy as much as China. Neither can I. Just get something in your hands. And it's not as if it's going to go stale. Even if you don't need it, your kids might. Call Oxford Gold Group, 833-995-GOLD. Let them help you prepare. We'll be back.
Hey there, I'm Mary Catherine Hamm.
And I'm Carol Markowitz. We've been in political media for a long time.
Long enough to know that it's gotten, well, a little insane.
That's why we started Normally, a podcast for people who are over the hysteria and just want clarity.
We talk about the issues that actually matter to the country without panic, without yelling, and with a healthy dose of humor.
We don't take ourselves too seriously, but we do take the truth seriously.
So if you're into common sense, sanity, and some occasional sass,
you're our kind of people.
Catch new episodes of Normally every Tuesday and Thursday
on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen.
pretty dangerous criminals there, right? Scary stuff. And, hey, maybe you're worried about running into one of those people tonight on your way to the car to get some bonbons from the gas station. Well, don't worry. 11 of those, or 10 of those people now face 11 years in prison for that crime right there. Joining me now, Aaron McIntyre, wonderful commentator, someone I listen to every chance I get, author of the book The Total State, which you should pick up if you want to understand what we're looking at here. Aaron, 87-year-old survivor of a communist concentration camp, going to be thrown in prison for 11 years in the United States of America for singing praise and worship songs, and still half the Christians won't vote in this upcoming election. That's where we're at in this country.
Well, Jesse, you know well that destroying Christianity is a core goal of any communist regime, whether it be in Spain, Russia, China. They hate Christianity. They know that it serves as a moral alternative, another base that shields people from the control of the state, the mind control, the brainwashing, the forcing of alien values into places like the home and the sphere of the community. And so obviously they're going to go after these people. It's not hypocrisy, it's hierarchy. The people who are the foot soldiers of the regime, they can go burn down your house, they can go ahead and burn down your church, they can go ahead and burn down your business. But if you're sitting there interrupting something that is sacred to the regime, you're going to jail.
Aaron, can you explain the complacency on the right? And I'm not just talking about practicing Christians, but we right now have open religious prosecution courtesy of the DOJ, and they're doing it in response to a Supreme Court ruling they don't like. That's how incredibly corrupt and inappropriate this is. Roe versus Wade gets overturned. The DOJ declares war on pro-lifers, and the right just doesn't care that much. Why?
There's an obsession with process. The right believes in order, and rightly so, right? We want to be the side of order. We want to be the side that follows the rules. That makes perfect sense. Until you realize that the institutions dictating those rules are completely captured. Until you realize that the rules are actually set up in a way not to build up your society, not to protect what you hold as traditional or sacred core to your identity as a people, but instead is set up to destroy those things. And so a lot of conservatives who naturally want to protect their institutions, naturally want to protect the rule of law and the order, have no idea how to react when the very institutions that are supposed to protect those things instead turn on them. So they're just sitting around saying, oh, what do we do next? What do we want to do next? Maybe we should just work the process harder. Maybe there's another way we can go ahead and follow the rules and more effectively, and then we'll have our victory. They don't understand that the entire thing has been turned on its head.
Aaron, when did it get turned on its head? I'm not old. I think I'm probably a little older than you, but I'm 42. But I've had a hard time trying to describe recently to my sons, they're 13 and 15, what America was like when I was a kid. I'm not some great grandpa. Come bounce on my knees, son, and I'll tell you about 15-cent cheeseburgers. I'm trying to explain to them what even television was like. And it's like I'm describing a totally different world.
Yeah, the key is really that it has been a slow process. It feels sudden to us now, but that's only because we have a little bit of perspective. If you look over time, you realize that the freedoms of the United States have been shifting for a long time. Most people don't talk about things like the fact that FDR stole all of the gold in the United States. We just don't talk about the fact that that happened because that would be really inconvenient to our understanding of things like the Constitution and rule of law. We don't really address the many different ways in which our government has grabbed for power for a very long time. But now that we've gotten into this radical position where it seems like anything, just a basic expression of faith or disagreement with government policy, can be used, can be weaponized by something like the DOJ to destroy your political enemies, all of a sudden it feels like the whole roof is collapsing on top of us. But actually, the frog has been boiling in the water. It just was boiling very slowly and has suddenly realized what kind of trouble it's in.
Are the American churches going to stand up and do anything about it? This is something I scream about all the time. It's essentially a standing army sitting there that could vote its way right back into complete cultural dominance if it would wake up, and they don't seem awake. What's going on?
Well, one of the core things that happened to the church is that in things like the 1980s, the moral majority campaigns ended up losing particular parts of the culture war. And the lesson that many pastors took from that was that the involvement of Christians in politics is what had made Christianity unpopular. And if only they could evolve with the times and stay away from controversy and show that they were cool and hip and with it, then they would be able to go ahead and draw people back to church. But what we found is that the more the church conforms to the world, the less it's interested in involving itself in politics or speaking into important areas, it simply becomes less relevant. It simply becomes just another social organization that people may or may not show up to, which is why many of the mainline Protestant denominations are dying off, while many of the other denominations that demand more of the people that go to their church are the ones that are flourishing. And so I think we will probably not see an overall change in the church's attitude, but we will probably see the churches that are speaking out, the churches that are taking action, the ones that are demanding more, draw people who are interested in change. And that could be a positive development, but I wouldn't expect to see all of Christianity rise up against this, unfortunately.
Aaron, you have a piece up about the danger of regime charity. What are you talking about?
So Mackenzie Scott, the ex-wife of Jeff Bezos from Amazon fame, of course, ended up giving a large amount of money to charity. I think it's something like $16 billion at this point. And a lot of people will look at that and say, oh, that's amazing. It's so great that she's handing out money to charity. And in her eyes, I'm sure she's trying to save the world. But in actuality, what she's doing is handing out large amounts of money to charitable organizations in theory, but in practice, they're actually organizations designed to reinforce the thought process of the regime, the morality and the norms of the regime. That money is funneled into these organizations, and they can do work that the actual government elected officials can't do. So, for instance, when the regime wants to go ahead and censor people on social media or get them fired, it would be a violation of the First Amendment, at least in theory, for them to go out and actively pursue that. But these charities can apply pressure to those different groups to try to get that censorship or that firing done under the name of being a charity. And so all of that money seems like it's going to help people, but in many cases, what it's actually doing is being donated to the total state, being donated to the powers that be and advancing the progressive worldview.
Aaron, thank you, my brother. Hey, by the way, before you go, the total state, what's it about?
Total state is a lot about what we just talked about, that expansion of government power into these places that are not traditionally thought of as political, as being part of the state, but end up consuming all of our personal spaces and driving us all towards this hyper-politicalization that distorts the Constitution.
Go get it. The total state, everybody. Aaron, I appreciate you as always, man. All right. There is still a massive operation going on in Baltimore. We lost an entire bridge. What happened there? Why is this going to take so long? What's going on? What does this mean for shipping, international shipping? I don't know any of these things, but Ross does. Ross Kennedy is going to join us next and give us an update on that. Let me give you an update on this. Violent crime is obviously up, way, way, way up. You know that, and I know that. They'll lie about it now. They're going to stop reporting on things, but you have eyes, you can see. We are importing more violent criminals, and the ones we have right here homegrown, we're turning them loose from jail. It's a bad problem. You have to own your own self-defense. You can't rely on calling the cops when a bad man meets you in a dark parking lot. You have to have something on you that will stop him. So that 25-year-old man who's lived a life of nothing but violence, can you stop him from doing what he wants to you outside of your car tonight? Burna can, the Burna pistol launcher, the non-lethal pistol launcher. I carry lethal and non-lethal. Everyone should carry non-lethal. I personally love to have both options on me. I carry my pistol, I carry my Burna. It shoots pepper balls or tear gas balls. It's legal in all 50 states. No background checks, no permits. Doesn't matter who you are, who your daughter is, your dad, your mom. Get them a Burna pistol launcher and carry it on you. And they're fun to shoot. They're fun to practice with. Do it right in your backyard. Pop, pop, pop with the whole fam. 10% off. BYRNA. Burna.com/Jesse. Go get one. We'll be back.
Hey, Hey there, I'm Mary Catherine Hamm.
And I'm Carol Markowitz. We've been in political media for a long time.
Long enough to know that it's gotten, well, a little insane.
That's why we started Normally, a podcast for people who are over the hysteria and just want clarity.
We talk about the issues that actually matter to the country without panic, without yelling, and with a healthy dose of humor.
We don't take ourselves too seriously, but we do take the truth seriously.
So if you're into common sense, sanity, and some occasional sass,
you're our kind of people.
Catch new episodes of Normally every Tuesday and Thursday
on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen.
Well, I know you're worried about this Baltimore bridge that came down and shipping and everything else going on, but fear not. Joe Biden is going to Baltimore on Friday. Let us hope he has all kinds of extra Secret Service protection in that town. So joining me now, because we don't have access to Biden's expertise just yet, is my friend Ross Kennedy, founder of Fortis Analysis, and he actually is an expert on all things shipping and whatnot. Ross, I understand you are on location in Baltimore as we speak. Are you currently being robbed?
I am not currently being robbed. No, I'm at Sparrows Point right now, very safe area of the city. Just left the Incident Command Center here a little bit ago and kind of got a flavor for what's, you know, for what's happening, what some of the challenges are, progress being made. It's been an interesting day so far, and it's certainly not over yet.
Okay, Ross, give us a breakdown, those of us who don't understand shipping, international shipping, bridges, things like that. What are the challenges? Because I'll be honest, brother, every person I talk to, especially over the past few days, all they're telling me is, wow, this is challenging. Wow, this is bad. This is going to take longer than I thought. I have not heard one positive report on, hey, we're moving things along and things are going great. What's happening on the ground?
So there's, you know, the good progress that's being made right now. You're seeing, you are starting to see some assets mobilize and move in. Incident Command Center is fully up and running. Certainly special compliments to Governor Moore here in Maryland, really has stepped in a way you don't always see state level leadership do to help make sure that, you know, resources are moving, that, you know, positive messaging is going out about it. Really, some of the biggest challenges that they're having here, though, is the fact that there's still a disintermediated, if you will, kind of chain of command happening where a lot of activity is happening inside different silos. They're having to bring it back together. There's not yet what seems to be kind of a clear operating picture, you know, of the entire challenge. You have the vessel itself that has to be salvaged. There is a salvage and marine recovery group that's working on that. They've got divers down right now. They're utilizing aerial imagery to help kind of keep a clear line of sight to things. But then you have a second company that's doing the salvage and recovery effort on the larger part of the bridge that's actually in the water. So you've got two different companies working in the same area, solving, you know, in different ways for some of what the same issue is. And then really above all of that, you have the Port Authority, and you have stakeholders from the different terminals, trucking companies as well. So there's a lot of people that don't, you know, that have skin in the game, but don't necessarily have a voice, if you will, to be heard as far as what, how their operations, their businesses are being impacted by all of this. And it really seems like we're still kind of weeks away from all of these entities talking to each other the way they should.
Okay, I'm glad you brought up that last part because that's really my next question, Ross. In fact, it's a two-part question. Who's in charge and who's paying for all this? Is this the U.S. government? Is this Maryland? This certainly is not going to be an exclusively private matter, at least I don't think, although you can obviously correct me on this. But as you well know, there needs to be one dude in charge, and it doesn't sound like that's the case.
So a large part of the recovery effort is being currently managed and checks are being distributed by the Navy. So they have an individual that's on scene that's primarily going to be concerned with trying to understand what the resources are and then moving the dollars through the public and private sector entities that you know, have the ball. They're the ones putting the cranes in. They're the ones putting divers in the water that are, you know, doing the cutting of the metal. On the private sector side, as far as, you know, funds, you know, the insurance provider and you know, local stakeholders, if you will, that are directly involved with the vessel They're going to be paying for the vessel recovery itself. But really, their checks stop when you get, as you can see in the photo that you guys are putting up now, there's about 4,000 tons of steel on top of the bridge. And that all requires experts who are cutting, welding, underwater diving. But their one mission in life is to get this vessel refloated and moved out of the way so the larger recovery effort that's being paid for by the Navy and implemented through the private sector with some Coast Guard, Army Corps of Engineers, involved in that as well. So there's several buckets of money that are all kind of involved here, and everybody's kind of trying to figure out where does your lane of effort, end, and thus your pile of money, and where does mine begin and my pile of money. And there's still some real, I think, confusion around how that's going to look and when one check writing authority turns off and another one turns on. And that really seems to be a big part of the challenge right now.
And that leads me to the private companies. As you mentioned, a major port like this, I believe it's top 15, top 10 in the United States of America. Tens of billions of dollars flow through there. There's a lot of private interests with a lot of money flowing back and forth that's not currently flowing back and forth, Ross. What do they do? If I've got Kelly's Cheeseburgers and we run shipping out of that port, how am I getting right?
That's right. So on the other side of the bridge disaster, if you will, that secret terminal that's like where Ports America, for example, operates, the largest container terminal here, they're effectively at a full standstill as far as waterborne operations. CSX Railroad has set up they're trying to get to it daily, but it's really kind of every couple of days now, about 100 containers at a time coming out of the port of New York. The Port of Norfolk has jumped in and activated a small vessel service that's running coastwise, being able to bring containers up. But the big challenge there is that all of your on-water capacity to be able to lift containers and move them to shore is on the wrong side of the bridge issue. So you do have Trade Point here, Trade Point Americas. That's the facility I'm sitting outside of right now, about to go in and talk to some individuals there and understand what their challenges are and, what we can do about it. This facility is capable as far as having the space to do it, but they don't have the cranes available. And it's also become kind of the staging location where a lot of the metal they are starting to cut and move on barge. They're just kind of having to lay it right there, on the pad, on the water, if you will. So there's still not the right kind of resources that are coming in from the private sector side, or the right questions in a lot of cases aren't even being asked. There's only a couple of companies that are trying to do all this planning as far as, who's all the stakeholders, what do they need, what assets and resources do they need? And right now the effort is so focused on refloating the vessel and beginning to remove pieces of the bridge that the economic stakeholders here, Amazon has got a huge distribution center behind me. You've got the car terminal as well, where a lot of the roll-on, roll-off work is being done. These guys are trying to utilize their resources as best as possible to be of assistance, but it's often forcing their own economic interests to take a back seat. And so that's really where a lot of the effort, people are trying to come in, they're flying in, they're doing what they can to try to be a part of the actual, salvage effort on the water. But at the same time, there's billions of dollars in economic activity here whose voices aren't being heard. The questions aren't being asked of what do you need, who can provide it, and how do we get it here? So a lot of the work that I'm doing here is trying to interface with these individuals and these organizations to try to bring some private sector solutions to the table where private sector is solving for its own challenges.
Okay, Ross, to wrap this up, explain this to me. Yes, I know it's a stupid question, I'm sorry, but why don't we have more ports? I mean, I could pull up a map of America right here and there's all this ocean. Why don't we have ports everywhere?
Well, a big part of the challenge is that over the last 20 to 30 years, as the U.S. has become less and less and less export dependent as far as economics, more and more and more import dependent, these vessels are getting much larger. They require, what we call a draft, which is the ability to operate below the waterline, how deep a vessel can go. And this has really driven the case of we only have a relatively few. I mean, we have some of the largest in terms of miles coastline in the world as a country. And so we have three shores that we can operate off of, but we really only have a few places that actually have enough natural, or you can dredge to a certain depth to be able to service these much larger vessels. when you're moving the much larger vessels, you need a lot longer cranes that have the ability to reach further out onto the ship and pick the containers off and bring them safely back to shore. Then you need an awful lot of laydown space or you know, concrete pads where you can put the containers, you can stack them, you can mount them to chassis and trucks and be able to get them moving. So as the ships have gotten bigger, as the corridors that these containers can move through on rail to move to the inland, or where trucks can have the room to come in and pick up and maneuver, all of that means you need more and more and more space. You need larger and larger and larger equipment. And that prices out a lot of opportunities to where you could do short sea shipping, smaller vessels, higher speed, reduced amount of infrastructure required, and begin to spread that effort. So the consolidation and size is really what's driving a lot of these challenges for how can we only have a few ports? Well, it's because there's relatively only a few places that can afford to do it from an infrastructure standpoint.
Gosh, I feel so much smarter now. Ross, as always, my brother, I appreciate you. You stay safe back there. All right. Now, before we go to lighten the mood, I want to remind you that the whole COVID stuff, the lockdowns, the whatnot, it reshaped our country. We're still seeing it everywhere. We have a special on COVID, on the reckoning, why we need one, a recap on everything. You're going to be able to catch that tomorrow, so stay tuned for that, all right? All right, we have Lighten the Mood next.
Hey there, I'm Mary Catherine Hamm.
And I'm Carol Markowitz. We've been in political media for a long time.
Long enough to know that it's gotten, well, a little insane.
That's why we started Normally, a podcast for people who are over the hysteria and just want clarity.
We talk about the issues that actually matter to the country without panic, without yelling, and with a healthy dose of humor.
We don't take ourselves too seriously, but we do take the truth seriously.
So if you're into common sense, sanity, and some occasional sass,
you're our kind of people.
Catch new episodes of Normally every Tuesday and Thursday
on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen.
All right, it's time to lighten the mood. And you know, we talk a lot about superpowers. If you're a dude, you talk about superpowers for sure. And I have two teenage sons, so believe me, superpowers come up from time to time. And I have this weird one that I want. And no one understands it until you start driving, and then you understand it. I should say my sons don't get it yet, but they will. You know what superpower I want? I want the superpower, when I'm driving, to pick a car and just safely, I don't want anyone to be hurt, shut that car down and force them to the side of the road where they have to stay for 15 minutes. That's what I want. I don't want anyone hurt, no one in the car, but I just, you're shut down for 15 minutes. You know why? Because many people are inconsiderate on the road. They drive around as if they're the only people on the road, and I can't stand it. So when I see videos like this, it nourishes my soul.
This is an iHeart podcast.